on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
There's also an element of trickster and kind of like culture change, which seems to happen in stories about him and people's experiences. And again, in the fairy lore, you find this again and again in those kind of those intercepted journeys. The individual is often faced with some sort of moral conundrum. That, you know, that there's morality plays in a lot of the folklore, and this dark figure, the dark man, is often the presenter of some moral question that the human protagonist in the story has to navigate. And this is where, you know, we start to talk about, is the devil evil? And my challenge to that is, if he's so evil, why is he asking moral questions of people?
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by writer, researcher, and award-winning photographer Darig Mason to discuss his book, Song of the Dark Man, Father of Witches, Lord of the Crossroads. Darig delves into the enigmatic figure of the Dark Man, exploring its manifestations and patterns across various cultures and folklore. He examines the Dark Man's role in initiation, nature, and the interplay between the material and immaterial to reveal a persistent archetypal presence. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Dara Mason is a writer, researcher, and award-winning travel and documentary photographer. Mason hosts the award-nominated podcast Spirit Box. Best known for his work on the Aghori and Djinn, he joins me today to discuss his book, Song of the Dark Man, Father of Witches, Lord of the Crossroads. Dara, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Really nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I found your book really interesting. I love things like this. Sometimes these deviate from some of my other podcast episodes, but I think they're important. So I thought that we should begin, and I'm going to take your lead here, something that you noted in the book, which is that we probably ought not to ask who is the Dark Man, but what is the Dark Man?
Yeah, it's, I think, definitely the right place to start with this phenomenon, with this entity. It seems to really defy any efforts to categorize, to pin it down, to really any attempts to understand its motivations in any robust way. What I kind of ascertained through my research into this area was there was a discernible pattern, but there's no true name, there's no true form, but there was a pattern that was identifiable as what this current might be, you know, and that's kind of the area that I started to pin down and go through the elements of that pattern in the book. And that really kind of led me to that area of, like, you know, the even the name kind of Dark Man, it kind of gives the sense that there is a who, but there isn't. It's very much beyond that. You know, what we might call in esoteric circles a royal spirit, you know, from which there are many emanations.
Okay. Can you discuss this pattern that you identified?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first element that's probably the most obvious is the type of name that is assigned to the spirit or emanations of the spirit. What seemed to kind of come up again and again was this dark appellation. So in Irish, we had the name Anfar Durka or Anfar Dove come up. So in what would translate as is the kind of the dark man, right? Anfar Durka. So which literally translates as the man dark, right? Or dove, dove meaning black, the old pronunciation being do. So this is where I started to pick out that pattern in Irish folklore, where we'd have figures with that name, or we'd have like figures come up in Irish folklore, like the Dark Rider, who would be this the next part of the kind of the pattern, being this kind of interceptor, right? So it would be this interrupted journey. Someone's journey would be interrupted by a kind of a meeting, or their journey is can't go forward because they've come up against this entity in some form. And in the Irish folklore, that was often portrayed as being the king of the fairies or the lord of the dead. And you see that we get this kind of wild blurring. So that, like, the Fear Dubh is also, or the Fear Dearca is essentially the word for the folk devil in Irish folklore, but he'll often be portrayed as the fairy king or lord of the dead, or one of these kind of old kind of pre-Christian pagan. And that kind of that appellation goes right back through to various different significant figures in Irish folklore, which we'll get to later. But the other parts of the pattern were shape-shifting. That happened a lot. Being a composite being, presenting as a composite being. And this bit goes way, way back to deep antiquity, where back to the kind of the cave art depictions of these spirits, where famously you've got Soranos, the horned man. You've got these therianthropic cave paintings of a human being with antlers, or with animal, predominantly kind of like deer feet, that kind of thing. And we see that with gods like Soranos, which I mentioned already, Pan, right up to kind of the traditional depictions of the devil. You know, the kind of the Abrahamic devil is depicted in that way, particularly Christian, where it's horned, it has the lower half of the body as that being of a goat, that kind of thing. So that composite being, we see that again and again, particularly in kind of some of the witch trial confessions. Repeatedly you get the figure being described as the black man, the black John, who could appear in many of these different forms. But repeatedly you get this part animal and a deer, the very significant theme that came up again and again. And then also you had this sexual interest in human beings. So that seems to be a recurrent theme for some reason. Now, I hypothesize in the book that that's something to do with the creative force that the Dark Man seems to represent in some way, or in part represent. So those were kind of the key elements of the pattern. There's also an element of trickster and kind of like culture change, which seems to happen in stories about him and people's experiences. And again, in the fairy lore, you find this again and again in those kind of those intercepted journeys. The individual is often faced with, oh, sorry, often faced with some sort of moral conundrum. That, you know, that there's morality plays in a lot of the folklore, and the this dark figure, the dark man, is often the presenter of some moral question that the human protagonist in the story has to navigate. And this is where, you know, we start to talk about, is the devil evil? And my challenge to that is, if he's so evil, why is he asking moral questions of people? Why is he making moral challenges? You know, there's one story in the book that I get into, which is from Lady Wilde's collection. It's Oscar Wilde's mum, and truly a talented family. And the story is of a young man called Jemmy Nolan. And he is on the way to a cattle mart just to sell his cows. And on the way there, he's thinking about what he's going to do with his money, you know, and it's the traditional stuff the young man would be interested in, which was kind of wine, women, and song, essentially. And that's what his goal was. So it's set out from the story that his ambition is pretty shallow in terms of what he's going to go and do if he's successful. His journey's intercepted, and he is taken to this palatial house, and he experiences this fantastic party, and you know, he's dancing, he's having a great time. And then he's asked, do you have a story to tell? What's You need to entertain us, tell us a story. And he doesn't have a story to tell. And that's that's essentially hinting at there's no depth to him, that he doesn't have anything of within his character that he can draw on and share with it. He's got no stories, you know, so it's questioning his whole integrity, his whole kind of life choices. Who is he? And when he says he doesn't have a story, he's grabbed by, he's the king of the fairies tells him, right, take him outside and kill him. And he's dragged outside of the stately home and brought out there, and there's a grave already waiting for him. No matter what he does, he can't break the grip of these people who've got him. And then eventually he manages to get his hands on a hazel rod and kind of beats them away with it. The hazel rod is quite significant. That comes up again and again in terms of initiating and breaking magic. And he's thrown in the grave. And then he's asked again, do you have a story to tell? And he's like, yes, I do. Yeah, I have a story to tell. But of course, the story is what's happened to him, you know, and that kind of breaks the spell. And immediately he values things differently. He sees his value set has changed. Now, it's a pretty traumatic experience. It's a pretty full-on experience. But that's what it's suggesting. It's basically saying to you, in the face of death, what has meaning to you in the everyday won't have any meaning. So recalibrate what matters to you, right? And that's kind of the morality play in the story. That's a little bit of a long-winded way of kind of going through those categories. But those are the patterns that are discernible.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot that came to mind when you were speaking. And I think that one of the questions that I have is, you refer to the dark man as an entity, and I want to ask about the agenda that the dark man seems to have. As you noted, it's not necessarily negative. I was also thinking that in the Hebrew Bible, the figure of Satan isn't evil. And the word Satan just means the adversary. And, yes, you know, when we talk about the devil's advocate, that's what Satan is, literally is the devil's advocate. And I think that at some point in the book, you make this distinction, or you look at this question of entity versus archetype. Mm-hmm. And I think if I remember correctly, it's that this notion of archetype for Jung is way more powerful than these sort of abstract things.
Yeah, yeah. You've hit the nail on the head there, you know, and I would be very much in Jung's camp in terms of how you would look at an archetype. And when you start to look at it from a Jungian perspective, then entity and archetype become less discernible, you know, and this is where I think that's why I kind of open with Jung's idea around kind of daemons and being in the grip of the daemon and what have you, because I don't think they're that discernible. So, which is why I use the term current sometimes, that there's a kind of an energetic current which can overwhelm people and is perhaps conscious in some way that we don't really understand. So in very short terms, and I hope it's not a perceived as a lazy answer, but I think it's both. You know, but very much kind of in the Jungian camp of a conscious archetype.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of how I want to phrase this, but there is a mystery to it. And I think that in the book, you give, you know, a lot of the folklore and the mythology. And then at the end, you have contemporary encounters with the dark man.
Yeah.
And I see something very large kind of happening because, and this isn't in the book, but I'm going to try to make the connection here. You mention a couple of times this interrupted or intercepted journey.
Yeah.
And the first thing that came to my mind when you said interrupted journey was that's the title of the book about the alleged alien abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. And yeah, I know that people like Jacques Vallée has made connections between the stories of UFOs and abductions mm-hmm. and fairies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with the kind of pattern that I laid out and those kind of characteristics, there's definitely crossover there. I mean, you look at sexual interest in human beings. We have case upon case of that in when you get into kind of alien abduction territory.
Right.
When I first started looking into the dark man kind of area, how I kind of first came to it was I originally was doing some photographic work in India around the jinn.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was, I guess, presenting that work back, when I got back to Europe, I did a lot of research to kind of build out, okay, how do I present what this is to people who may not know what the jinn are, and kind of, so I did a lot of research into it, primarily through a book called by Robert Liebling called Legends of the Fire Spirits, which is an excellent book if anyone's interested in that kind of area. And I started to notice there's a real correlation between jinn and fairies. I mean, like really specific stuff, you know, like jinn travel in the wind, fairies travel in the shi-giha, which is literally the fairy wind. Just similarity after similarity, like jinn are associated with treasure and finding treasure, and like, you know, what's at the end of the rainbow is the pot of gold and all that kind of stuff, right? So there's just huge overlaps in it. And I started picking up on the kind of the dark man motif, the dark rider, that kind of stuff, right? That motif coming up in the fairy lore. At the same time, I was looking at starting up my podcast and interviewing people about magic, about folklore, about the world of the spirits. And I kept coming up against this figure, excuse me, that particularly witches would mention, this kind of this initiatory figure that would appear in dreams or as an apparition, sometimes just like super visceral experiences where they got, you know, in to quote some of them, they got switched on, right? Mm. You know, that kind of the current went through them, and that's when they went down that path in earnest, right? So hence Witchfather, right? So
right.
Now, while I was looking at this at the same time, I was like, this is the Men in Black. This is a whole kind of alien thing about the Men in Black. Is that similar? You know, and I was chatting to Joshua Cutchin, who's a fabulous researcher into this area.
Yeah, and Josh on the podcast.
Super kind.
Yeah.
And I was discussing this and how you've got the whole Men in Black thing where they appear slightly out of time. Mm. You know, their clothes are 20 years out of date. That kind of thing. You have the same thing with fairies. They always kind of, there's notable that their clothes seem to be several decades out of date in how they appear. So that was one thing that was notable. Like the Banshee, you know, the Banshee doesn't turn up in jeans. You know, it's like, I say that as a Gen X, you know,
right.
As a Zoomer. But, you know, those similarities are there. Now, that's as far as kind of my research went into that. Like I very much kind of settled on the witchcraft stuff was the kind of strongest kind of vein that I tapped into and that I would argue I was kind of pushed towards. But there are definite similarities there. There's no doubt about it. And is it the same phenomenon manifesting in a different way? I honestly, I don't know, but I wouldn't rule it out as a possibility. You know, like Jacques Vallée's thesis on it is very robust.
Yeah.
You know, when he goes down, I mean, we talk about fairies, like you get there's specific fairies, the Lanashi, you know, who are vampiric and have again a very strong sexual interest in human beings. In Kirk's what's the name of the book? What's it called? It's like the Invisible Kingdom or the Hidden Kingdom. I can't remember what the actual title of it is. It's Scottish pastor from I think the 16, 1700s. He wrote about it. Highlanders having this experiences of fairy women trying to take the Highlanders as partners, yeah, as sexual partners. So comes up again and again. And again, the same thing with jinn lore, where you have like big spirits like Aisha Kandisha purported to have 30,000 husbands in Morocco, where these men become possessed with the idea of this spirit, who incidentally comes across as being part human, and their lower limbs are that of a horse.
Hmm.
You know, so there's huge correlation. It's very much seems to be a global thing. For the nature of this book, I settled on the folklore and mythology that I was closest to, that I grew up with.
Right. Yeah. And again, there's a lot that's coming to my mind. And I know that we're limited on time for my fault, not yours. I find the question again about the agenda, whatever this is. You know, one of the things that you note in the book is, and it seems to come up a couple of different times, is that of initiation, that the people who are having the experience of the dark man are being initiated. But then that always begs the question for me, well, initiated into what?
Well, the short answer is witchcraft. The longer, more protracted answer is, well, what is witchcraft? Now, I'm sure you get kind of a good 100 different answers as to what that question could we get from people. But from my perspective, and kind of the reason I talk about caves and cave art and specifically in this is fundamentally witchcraft is a relationship with nature that is material and non-material. You know, it is reaching out to nature spirits, spirits of the dead, and working with them. I think part of the agenda of the dark man is to keep that heart beating, that throughout time, even when it meant a death sentence, people were still being called and initiated into witchcraft. And we're very lucky in the sense that we have a body of trial documentation from the kind of the Great Witch Hunts in Scotland. And while it's not universal, there are repeated accounts of the dark man being seen with various people who've been both male and female being tried for witchcraft. And when you do have those accounts, the strong themes come through of the presenting as part animal, notably part deer, shape shifting, and again, sexual interest in human beings. Those themes come up again and again. The most probably the most famous account is with Isabel Gowdy, and there's an extremely lurid three-part confession. And it starts with her on a journey, and her journey is interrupted by the dark man, who she called Black John, who told her to come back that night to the kirk, the church at Old Aldern, where she was initiated into witchcraft, kind of rebaptized as him. And an awful lot of those kind of ceremonies that were the accounts of the witch's Sabbath, where reversals or kind of like the negative reflections of Christian ceremony and what have you.
Right.
What I think is important is the context that this was generally happening to immensely poor people with extremely challenging lives, living on kind of like the periphery, not just of Europe, but the periphery of life. You know, there were serfs essentially. And often we find it in the accounts that these experiences happened after some kind of tragedy. There were people widowed or people had a serious illness, this kind of thing. So there was some sort of like traumatic event that created the window for this to happen. And it was an a kind of an extreme inversion of the kind of the socioeconomic order. All of a sudden, the poorest people, you know, kind of poor women, you know, who were serfs, had some kind of recourse, had some sort of power, you know. And I mentioned in the book is that we the dark man appears where kind of, you know, where in a lot of ways where injustice has prevailed. And I don't want to paint a picture that there's like kind of like, you know, some sort of like superhero vibe going on here, but because I don't think that's the case, but it is talking about kind of people with virtually nothing being given a kind of power through their initiation. Equally, there's a really chaotic element to that, but let me finish that kind of an initial point. When we think about that, what they're given is injustice against landlords, where that, you know, the disparity would be like us today versus kind of billionaire class, right? There's just like there's no comparison in terms of power. They're virtually godlike in terms of their capability reach to your average person. similarly, this would have been the case, you know, and you're utterly at their behest. There's a totally polarized kind of power spectrum. Witchcraft changed that. Didn't necessarily kind of like make it a level playing field, but essentially it meant that the Lord on the hill was touchable. Mm-hmm. You know, if they transgressed against the community, there was recourse, you know, through magic, through cursing. And indeed, a lot of the cases that came to trial were accusations around not just kind of black magic and witchcraft in the community, but against the aristocracy. And there is where you have these gaps in medical knowledge at the time. There was also kind of the herbal knowledge that came with, not necessarily through the dark man, but certainly through witchcraft and the tutelary spirits that people would be assigned, because they would often kind of be assigned familiars of some description from the dark man or an emanation of him. So I think to some degree, it's leveling the playing field there, but equally, it keeps the heartbeat of what I would argue is a very, very ancient human practice. I don't want to say religion, because that kind of hints at that there is a golden thread of belief and you know, tenets, and there simply isn't, you know. So, but there seems to be a coherent repetition of a pattern throughout time.
Okay.
And that plays out in our stories, which is the other bit around. So when we talk about initiation, the other bit, which I hint at, and what I talked in the first chapter of the book, is the creative kind of current that comes with the dark man. And we see it in music, with stories around like Robert Johnson going to the crossroads, his guitar is tuned by the dark man, which is probably like a kind of an African-American version of the story of the current. And he's bestowed with talent and becomes this great artist, you know, and has a huge influence in music. But we see it in stories. There's that opposer figure, that kind of the adversary figure that comes up in stories and drives the narratives along. And one of the best examples I saw of it recently was the TV series Fargo. In the first series, you have a character called Lauren Malvo. And if you watch that through the prism of the dark man, his figure, when he's courted by the Martin Freeman, he's a British actor. I can't remember the character he plays in Fargo, but he's this kind of pathetic, downtrodden figure, and everything goes against him. And essentially, Lauren Malvo takes pity on him, meets him in A&E. He's been beaten up by his old bully, right? Humiliated by his old bully, even as a kind of a middle-aged man. And essentially, there's the morality question of, like, you know, because Lauren Malvo's an assassin. Apologies for any spoilers. It starts a whole story where this man, who is essentially dealt this crappy hand in life, but also doesn't have much fortitude himself, gets everything he wants, but he goes too far in that. You know, he overreaches, and it all kind of comes crumbling down. So the morality play is there. It's a really good show as well.
Yeah, I've not seen it. What comes to my mind is the series Hellier by Greg and Dana Newkirk, which is a sort of boots on the ground, sort of paranormal investigation. And so many of the themes that are in the Dark Man or in the lore also come out in that series. And it's supposedly nonfiction. It's quite interesting. And one of the main themes in their second season was that they felt like they are being initiated, and they're not entirely sure into what or who might be behind it, but it takes place in the Appalachians. And I know towards the end of the book, some of the people that you're speaking with are really rooted in the Appalachian Mountains, which are one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world. And there does seem to be something other there.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. That's the witch Orion Foxwood, yeah, who's hugely knowledgeable in this area and kind of like really was gave me a lot of the foundational information around what the crossroads meant, you know, why it is a place of power and what have you. And there's subtle differences kind of throughout where, you know, this is where we kind of brush up against the same current, but the Lord of the Crossroads that Robert Johnson met versus who the kind of the dark man may, you know, may be, or the dark rider actually, this is the name at in Appalachia. It's the same current, but they present differently, you know, and the ways of kind of invoking are different and vary. And this is again continually why it's so difficult to pin down the kind of the detail here. Yeah, it's extraordinary, really.
Well, the crossroads are liminal spaces, I think, and that's something that I've read or before, especially when people are talking about sort of paranormal activities or experiences, that they tend to happen in liminal spaces.
Very much so. So it is this whole thing of like betwixt and between, right? These nowhere places. And it goes down to this interrupted journey, because if you think about it is a liminal thing. You're going from, say, your home to another place. You're in neither. You're in that space. You're betwixt and between your origin and your destination. So it's there in the folklore too, you know. And I would kind of push it further and say, kind of, when you look at the boundaries of place where you are between, you're in the borderlands between civilization in whatever form that might be and the wild, this is where these things happen. You know, it's where these two places brush up against each other, and they're neither, where we tend to kind of interface with spirits of this kind of, yeah.
I'm really interested in the nature part of this, that there is the, you know, like Pan is the old nature god. And one of the things that you wrote in the book, I just found this really interesting because I've got a background in kind of environmental ethics and
Oh,
ecological
cool.
writing. But one of the things that you noted, and this kind of tacks onto this notion of sexuality, and I'm going to read this direct quote here. Christianity's virgin birth to a celibate God severed copulation from female sexuality in particular, removing it from its rightful place of veneration to a place of revulsion and fear. This tragedy led to the desacralization of the earth, which combined with monotheism and the demonization of the dark man is catastrophic. And, you know, I've often, you know, the literature in academic circles tends to focus on the biblical text that suggests that humans have dominion over the planet. And there's certainly a connection between the nature and the feminine and whatnot. But I thought that you took it a necessary step further in terms of bringing in the sexual aspect.
Yeah, and I think this is in part where the sexual interest from a symbolic perspective comes with this current. That I when we in the accounts of the witches, we have these, and Isabella Gowdy accounts, for example, like very, very graphic conversations of the witches never refusing Black John, and that he would go from witch to witch the Sabbath, you know, copulating with them all. Go into like descriptions of saying that like his male organ was immense, and that the women had great, great, tremendous sexual pleasure out of it as well. And at the same time, he could also be very cruel and could beat the witches as well. So I mean, again, I don't want to paint a picture that it's all kind of, you know, all roses. It's not. These are terrifying accounts and terrifying experiences. I wager that this kind of sexual congress that has that is a account with this tremendous pleasure is in itself a ritual that is a homage to the creative force, to the regenerative force of that we as human beings, as living things, are expressions of, and that it is one of the greatest tragedies of a lot of Abrahamic faiths, where we have this kind of corruption of female sexuality into something that is feared or portrayed as dirty or what have you. And there's a kind of another an analogous piece to that, which is in the same chapter as the quote you gave, where it talk about the kind of the nature of the cave. So we have the I mentioned cave art at the kind of the start of our conversation, and that being that there's a cave in France called the Trois Frères cave, where there's a depiction known as the sorcerer, which is this composite being, right? There's these are kind of quite frequently, but the cairns that kind of the kind of pre-Celtic people built in Ireland are kind of like they emulate the cave, right? They emulate that kind of womb interior of the earth. There's an embodiment of the goddess as the earth. We see this in the there's a twin mountains just outside Killarney in County Kerry that are called the Paps of Annwn, which are literally the breasts of the goddess Danu, right? And that is exactly what they look like. So that's survived through kind of the Christian kind of cleansing of that, right? You know, these were places of pilgrimage, there were places of homage. They still are in part today, you know, but it certainly would be indicative of an understanding that the landscape is the body of the goddess.
Right.
And there, the valleys, the caves, the gorges are the vulva of the goddess. And we think of stories like, I mean, dozens of fairy stories where you go into the earth, you go into the cave, into the
Right.
earth, under the bough of a tree, into some hollow, you go into another world. Like the Pied Piper, the side of the mountain opens and they go into it, into another world, right? So this is where we then have the shift in perception, the shift in belief, where the vulva of the goddess becomes the hell mouth, the entrance into hell. It's
Yeah.
a total reversal. You know, and that's I think that's the same thing, right? You know, and of course we're wrapped up in that is the understanding that the dark man is a evil thing, whereas it's complex because it's a representation like the dark daemon of nature. And nature is beautiful. It's also brutal. It's tooth and fang. You know,
Yeah.
life feeds on life. That is, can I say the nature of nature? Not sure.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a clunky phrase, but you get what I'm trying to
Yeah,
say.
yeah, yeah, yeah. The essence of nature, maybe.
Yeah, there we go. Much better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I do like the nature of nature as well. I think that that comes across quite well. And you know those the caves, these Paleolithic caves, you know, like Le Trois Frères and some of the other ones, their thought, you know, one of the ideas is that they were places of initiation.
100%.
Yeah.
You know, and if you think about it, like some of these caves were extraordinarily difficult to get into, you know, and they still are, even with kind of modern equipment, modern exploration equipment, to get into a cave, and then do that kind of art in the cave is indicative of this has some kind of sacred meaning, right? You know, it is an immensely challenging thing to do to get into a cave in the pitch black, maybe, you know, carrying some sort of like primitive light source, whatever that might be, and then paint the walls. You know, it is telling us this place had meaning. You know, we can only hypothesize to what that meaning may be. But it's interesting that these therianthropic figures are depicted in these caves repeatedly. You know, so yeah, there's something potent to it.
Yeah, well, and it also makes sense to see the cave as like the womb, especially if it's an initiation, because it can represent a sort of rebirth out of.
And certainly in some of the experiences of the witches I interviewed, they talk about a place called the Dark Room, which is this chthonic place that seems to be in a cave with this expansive, body of water within it, this dark water. And I've had it described to me as it's like this cold furnace of creation, that it is that, if the cave entrance is the vulva, then this is the womb within. And again, these things are hugely symbolic. It's a language of symbolism again and again. It's telling us, these incredibly complex and kind of like deeply challenging ideas that kind of language just doesn't have the capability to articulate these ideas, these notions, so it's displayed in symbolism, and I think a lot of it comes down to things like dualism and kind of non-dualism, particularly like the kind of part man, part human, part animal. It's telling us that we're not separate from nature. It's telling us that the kind of the separation is not as substantial as we would believe. And conversely, to kind of like back to your point, that I can't remember the exact quote it is in the Bible, where it's like God has given you the animals and plants of the earth to use, which is subjugation. The dark man is telling you your nature isn't subordinate to you. You are part of it.
Yeah, I had on my notes here the illusion of dualism to talk about, because that's exactly what I was seeing, is the reminder that humans are animals and we are nature. And
Yes,
we like
absolutely.
to say, humans and animals and nature and culture, and these are all false dichotomies.
100%.
And you also identified this, I think, in one of the old stories of Finn McCool, where, if I remember right, the dark man takes on the form of Finn.
This is kind of one of the really interesting things that I picked up in the folklore was, essentially, to give it a bit of background, we have this idea of a fairy woman who's, excuse me, being transformed into a deer. This comes up again and again, and that again, it goes kind of all the way back to like 12th century manuscripts. Some of the language hints that how the language is structured hints at kind of a linguistic, or like a predating that linguistically in terms of how it's laid out. But basically, we have this concept of a fairy woman who's been transformed into a deer with the sole intention of tricking, in this case, the Fianna, into taking her in, right? So what happens in the account of Fionn MacCool, and the story is basically about the kind of the birth of Oisin, who's Fionn MacCool's son. He's out hunting deer, Fionn is. And him and his hunting dogs come across a doe, and the dogs won't attack the doe, so it's very strange. Brings the doe back into his fort that night. He's in his quarters. This beautiful, beautiful woman called Saiva comes into his chamber, and basically says, "I need your protection from this terrible black magician of the men of God, this terrible dark man of the Sidhe." She being fairy, who she kind of lays out as this force that looks out from the hedgerows, looks up from the streams, is everywhere, this kind of omnipotent force that she's afraid of. And Fionn is besotted and says, I'll protect you. I'll protect you from this force. And she basically says, good, because the dark man wants me to marry him, but I won't marry him because I'm in love with somebody else. And he's immediately gripped with jealousy, until he finds out it's him who she's going to marry, at which point he's delighted. And they have a short time together where they have a deep, deep love. And as all these human fairy romances, they never work out. They never work out. He has to go off as part of his duty to fight some Vikings who are invading. And she waits dutifully in his fort. And then she sees him coming up the road, returning from battle, and she runs out to greet him outside of the protective confines of his fort, where it broke the spell initially. And as she runs up to Fionn, he transforms. And it's the Dark Man who put a glamour on to appear as Fionn. And he touches her on the head with a hazel wand, and she immediately transforms back into a deer. And Fionn never sees her again. Now, 7 years later, he's out searching Ireland constantly for her. And he finds a young boy with a shock of blonde hair like his, the countenance that's similar to Siva's. And the boy recounts being in a faraway place behind a great cloud. There was a deer who looked after him and brought him fruit and berries and what have you. And sometimes this dark man would arrive and shout at the deer and be very angry, and he was afraid of him. So Fionn realizes it's his child and calls him Oisín, which means little deer. Now, Oisín is half fairy. So in himself, in that character's very being, is a non-dualistic metaphor. He is half human, half fairy, half here, half other. And he ends up linking this kind of age of heroes to the age of Christianity through part of his story where he has to go. He returns to fairyland with a fairy woman who called Niamh Kinnor, which means Niamh of the Head of Gold. And this time in fairyland is 3 years, but he comes back and it's like 3 centuries later, and it's the age of heroes is gone. It's the age of Christianity. And he is the taboo he's given in order to return is not to touch the ground. But circumstances betray him, and he ends up falling from his horse and touches the ground and instantly transformed into an old man. And there's these series of books or chapters in the story of Oisín, I think they're called the Arguments, where he debates with Saint Patrick, right? And these are all written by kind of they're distilled from kind of stuff that the monks would have written down in kind of the between the 8th and 12th century. And they're very forgiving to Oisín. So basically, Patrick's saying because Fionn and the noble Fianna were not Christian, they're in hell, right? And Oisín was like, well, this is awful. These men were courageous heroes. And I mean, it's quite funny in part. He calls like the monks like bell ringers and clerks, and they'd happily lop their heads off and all this kind of stuff, right? Which is great. But it bridges this gap. But it's also indicative of this dual practice, right? That the Irish mind was able to hold these two kind of seemingly very polarized ideas, but actually they fitted quite well together. You know, there's no way that that would have been allowed be maintained, you know, where a passage of text would be forgiving to the age of the heroes and to somebody who was half fairy, right? But they seem to kind of not exactly, you know, weren't best buddies, but they certainly could coexist as concepts. And so I think that's that kind of what that hinted at.
Okay. Yeah,
But the deer
there's
motif comes up again in the witchcraft.
right. How does that come up again in witchcraft?
Well, we mentioned Joshua Cutchin earlier. One of his quotes that I really like is that kind of inversion is representation. And when Isabel de Gowdy describes the Dark Man, she specifically says he would appear with, sometimes he would have boots on, sometimes he would have cloven feet, sometimes he would come in the form of a ray. And a ray is an archaic word for a roe type of deer. You know, so he would literally appear as a deer to them. An extraordinary bridge between the mythology, folklore, and then witchcraft accounts.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are at the end. And again, this is my fault. I have to run to class. But let me ask you, what are you working on next? What do you have coming up?
Well, principally talking about the book for the next while, but other than that, I have a podcast called Spirit Box. I put out 2 shows a month, and I have a Patreon. We do kind of extra bits and bobs on. We talk about lots of interesting folklore bits and yeah, loads of different things. But if this is an area of interest, then that's probably the best place to find me. Just Google kind of Dara Mason. You'll find my photographic website and
Okay.
links to kind of where I am.
All right.
Instagram, basically.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, I'll look for that and put some of that information in the show notes in the video description, as well as links for the book, Song of the Dark Man. I really enjoyed it. And I'd read Josh Cutchin's Ecology of Souls. So I saw
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
some parallels there. I spoke to him as well. And yeah, I think I love this kind of work. And I think it's important work. And I think it's exploring what is still a mystery And
Yeah.
I think that's one of the important reminders, maybe, of the dark man, is there is still mystery in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, very well put.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Nick. Really
All right.
appreciate
Well,
your
all
time.
right. Yes. Thank you. I really appreciated it as well. And that's a wrap on episode 164 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media too, please, and subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following are all free, and they really do help. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. Yes, really, I am. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness and psychedelics, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.